Hi, everyone, and welcome to the podcast. Today, I'm going to dive into a due diligence process that I've created in relation to a company called Satlantis. Now, if you're a listener to the podcast, you would have recently seen Alex Svetsky on the show, and just before him as well, Jordy. Alex is the CEO and founder, spoke in great detail as to why he came across the problem and how he's going to solve it and the opportunity that represents. So this podcast is going to be a step-by-step guide through a useful framework that helps me understand whether or not a startup business is a good bet. But by the end of this video, you're going to have a pretty good understanding for A, how do you analyze an early stage idea, and B, what my opinion is on Satlantis. I'm going to try and do some screen share stuff, so hopefully that works. Additional context here being, I'm a Bitcoin maximalist, and with that comes a lens on the world that in some ways I'm still honing, but I am extremely bullish on Bitcoin. I'm an advocate for it. So every single day I'm out there talking to people about it. And for me, the best risk reward bet you can possibly take right now is Bitcoin in self-custody. Now, the question becomes, it's like when you've got this increased purchasing power, what do you do with it? And a reasonable suggestion is actually taking some profits and cycling those into other areas that you are bullish on. And something that I think is not a bad idea is finding companies that are building on top of Bitcoin to make bets with. And Satlantis fits that very nicely. But the thing I think which has really fit into place for the first time for me on this journey is that, like, investing in a company building a Bitcoin wallet, I just didn't see how that was going to be a massive company. Bitcoin mining, it's definitely a profitable business if you get it right, but it's extremely hard. Bitcoin exchanges, well, okay, fine. Had you hit Coinbase early doors, then you would have made a lot of money, but they're a huge shitcoin casino. And I'm just not interested in advocating for the altcoin market at all. I want to be purely focused on Bitcoin. And then an exchange is also, in some ways, it's restrained by its physical location. So you have exchanges that are specific to the US or specific to Australia or the UK, etc. Anyway, along comes Nostr and the invention of digital ID in the hands of the user. And that's the key bit here. It's user-centric digital ID. It's absolutely massive with a key pair. So you have your MPUB and your NSEC. And with that, you start to see a whole new world opening up. And I think there are going to be extraordinary opportunities to invest in early stage companies that are combining Nostr with Bitcoin. And Satlantis is a good example of that. And that's why it plays into my thesis. So without any further ado, let me try and share my screen. This is the Satlantis deck. Alex sent it to me last week. You can get hold of this. I'll leave one PDF in the show notes. That's no problem. And there's lots of detail in here as to like what's going on with the business, where the idea came from, who's in the team, specific details about the raise itself, what's the business model, how they're going to actually grow, how might they exit, etc. And the reason I'm flicking through this so fast is I encourage you to actually pick through it and have a look. I've seen loads and loads and loads of pitch decks over the years, and it's ultimately personal preference as to what you put in there. But safe to say, this was absolutely appropriate for what I was looking for. Now, the main thing I want to share with you is here. So this is a GDoc that I put together. Again, I'll share it as a PDF, but the framing here is, you know, why would you buy equity in an early stage company? And if you were going to buy equity in an early stage company, how do you even figure that out? And so I've gone through this really, really simple basis, but these are the things that I think are important to think about, number one. And then number two, it's like, what do I actually think? So what are the 10 most important questions to ask yourself when looking at an early stage equity investment? Number one, who are the founders and what is their track record? It cannot be overemphasized how important it is that you're investing in a person. And you know, you think of investing, you think of like an Excel spreadsheet and numbers. But this is not about numbers. This is about people and what they can create from scratch. So what you're putting your money into is the ability for a team to use their varying array of expertise to develop something that grows, people like and pay for. Now, a couple of obvious things with this, like, are they relevant to the industry? Have they built and sold a company before? And can they get other talented people to come and join the team? Some of my specific thoughts, I've already touched on this, that nothing is more important than the team at this stage. And basically, I'm a big fan of Alex Fetsky. So Alex came on Bitcoin with Jake a couple of years back. And since then, I've seen him go on to create loads of cool things, make a ton of progress. And, you know, just to name a couple of others, he wrote the Young Communist Manifesto with Mark. He exited Amber, which is a business I know of here in Australia, and got that to a place where it was an interesting company. What he's building now is a lot more interesting. He wrote The Bushido of Bitcoin. Now, I haven't finished that book yet, but it talks a lot about mentality. And it's that in particular that I like. So, you know, go back and listen to the Bitcoin with Jake episode if you want. Have a listen to the Jake Woodhouse podcast episode just recently come out. And you'll get a good flavor for like who Alex is and why he's doing this. And it's really, he is the key driver here. So if I didn't have faith in him, I wouldn't be putting any money into this business. And on the flip side of that, it's like, if I have extreme faith in him, it's like, well, why wouldn't you? I've said here, I'm interested to bet on building on a Bitcoin standard and pumped to put into practice their philosophy to create huge value. You go through the Bushido of Bitcoin and it's about strength, valor, integrity. And it's a fascinating read because it really gets you thinking about the mindset of the people that Bitcoin is enabling. A small thing being Alex reached out to me to come on the podcast and I got peppered by as many different channels he could think of that he knew of me on. So I think it was an email, a telegram, and on Twitter. And I'm like, what a legend. Like, think how powerfully he will hunt down potential customers, potential clients, potential investors on behalf of his company when you get that kind of aptitude. It's really cool. And I just love that kind of hustle. So, and the final point here is I've seen some of his writings over the years, which are almost like, just like an angry young man. And in some ways, like, amazing effort for actually vocalizing that. And it's something that I too have felt at times. It's like, what the hell is going on in the world right now? But what I see now is a maturity that wasn't there before. And that I think is really cool. Combined with the fact he's built himself a digital audience that really like what he's doing. It's like, this is the kind of person that really could pull off something extraordinary. And that's what, you know, startup investing is. It's extraordinary. Like, most of these businesses fail. But how do you reduce that risk? Well, one, betting on good team. And we'll go through the rest of this, but building on a Bitcoin standard as well. Like, these startups are going to have Bitcoin in the balance sheet. Like, big, big difference. Number two, is there a real and painful problem being solved? Is it something that is very costly to solve? Would an individual or business try to solve it? And importantly, like, is this something that needs to be solved? Or is this a solution hunting for a problem? An example of a solution hunting for a problem is people that copied the Bitcoin blockchain code and are now out there punting blockchain as decentralized, but they're actually highly centralized companies with expensive databases with their own token. Like, I do not see the actual use case for them. And Bitcoin is ultimately the only blockchain I think we'll ever need. That's a story for another day, but really think about this yourself. Do I feel this problem? Like, you're putting money into an early stage idea. And if you don't truly believe in the problem they're solving, then why bother? And so when I think about my wife and I, when we go traveling, you know, we get recommendations from all over the place. Like, it's a mess, right? WhatsApp, Google Maps, Google, Instagram, Twitter, even like, you know, a digital version of Lonely Planet now, TripAdvisor maybe, Condé Nast we really like, Condé Nast Traveler, ChatGPT now. You know, shout out to Daz, who's doing a trip around Australia with his family, using ChatGPT to recommend a certain beach within a certain distance that has a certain type of surf break. Now, that's definitely part of the future. But like, you know, is the Google Map review real? Like, you get to a place and actually the photographs are like really old. And how expensive is it? I don't know. Like, is the weather good at that time of year? And I think the summary is I've definitely felt this problem as a traveler, just endless scrolling. And if Alex could somehow pivot into this, like, searching on Airbnb, I hate it. And so that's the accommodation piece here. But let's see, that might be part of the roadmap later on. But the main one for us is dietary requirements. It's like, I don't know if a restaurant's menu is going to cater to what my wife needs. And that means it can take us forever to choose somewhere. And it's painful as anything. This could be much better. The flip side to all this as well is, as someone as a content creator, the digital censorship that we have witnessed over the last, couple of years, it's been off the charts. And so is it right that people are communicating online on the digital real estate of a company, a private entity that is open to the highest bidder in terms of its customers to censor speech? I come down heavily on the side of Nostr's an incredible tool that we really haven't quite understood the importance of yet because of the ability for a user to communicate online and control their own identity and control their own communications. So that's fascinating. So that's a big part of the problem, but it's not directly obvious because actually they're aiming this at frequent travelers. So there's a very, very clear niche. Number three, what is the size and growth potential of the market? You know, people talk about something called a TAM, so a total addressable market. If I was to look at, you know, a TAM, you need a big one, essentially. It really, really helps to have a big market to go after. Is it something that's actually expanding or do you see it getting smaller? And the reason for having like a really big market to go after is at an early stage, you're just not quite sure where product market fit is going to be. Like, where is liftoff? And so it's this fine line between trying something new, getting a bit of traction. Is that enough traction to carry on investing in this something new thing? Or do you need to try something slightly different? And so there are tons of stories of companies that became breakout growth businesses that they break out with a product that isn't what they started with. And so a key part of allowing that to happen, i.e. giving the founder and their team enough time and space to figure that out, is A, funding them well, but B, attacking a big market. So they've got plenty of space to kind of pivot their way through. And I make the key point here that like after the team, the most important thing to look at is market size, in my opinion. So a great team going after a shitty market, complete waste of time. Or said another way, a very difficult way to return any capital. And on the other hand, you could have a probably quite average team going after what turned out to be a rockstar market, and you could see really good returns. So again, thinking about like, do I travel much? Yes. Will I travel more in the future? Yes. What's the travel industry doing in general? How many people are traveling around? It's clearly growing. I was blown away by the stat that Alex gave me about the fact that there are something like 30 to 50 million digital nomads. Now, that's a country the size of France. I mean, it's absolutely huge. And all those people are spending money, traveling around the whole time, and inevitably back in that kind of doom scrolling space that I spoke of before in terms of like trying to find somewhere to eat or trying to find somewhere to stay or trying to find somewhere to hang out or get a coffee or work out or whatever. They're flicking between lots of different apps at the same time. This very clear understanding from Alex's perspective as to like, okay, you've got the people that travel, maybe that's once a year. And then you've got the people that travel like a couple times a month. So that's the frequent traveler. Then you've got someone who's on the road constantly and considers themselves a digital nomad. And he even touched on something called location independent, which is a phrase I really liked. To me, that's someone that's really thought very deeply about these different tiers. So number four, what is the startup's unique value proposition? Why are these guys the only people in the world that can build this idea right now? And therefore, what are the competitive advantages? You know, are there some tailwinds, technologies? Are you confident that they're not just throwing buzzwords at you? Like, think about how many people have raised money saying, we're an AI startup. Doing what? Creating what revenue? For who? What's the exit plan? Like, there's just so many bullshitters out there, basically. So just beware of that. This is a good way of muscling through the bullshit. A clear trend that I'm very bullish on is this convergence of artificial intelligence, Bitcoin, and Nostr. And Satlantis is going to leverage all three. And in my view, they're the first startup I've seen that is actually investable based on those three being combined. And it's combined within a very specific avatar. Now, in the past, it wasn't even possible to build upon these three technologies. So in some ways, it's like a first mover advantage in that sense. Like, or there's very few companies that are actually doing this right now. And just some insights from my own perspective, like the way that you can move from Nostr client to Nostr client, take your followers, your data, your proof of work social graph, this is like an unbelievable light bulb moment. And you know, it's, you take your Instagram followers to TikTok, to YouTube. It's just wild, right? And what Alex was really clear on and helped me solidify for the first time, which is that with Bitcoin's is just a one of a kind. And you want to accumulate and own as much of that Bitcoin network as possible. And all the value that a society generates is going to flow into the best form of money. And that's why I'm so bullish on Bitcoin long term, because it's almost like a metric on human productivity and sound money. The case with Nostr is actually no one's going to own the Nostr protocol in the same way that you can own a piece of the Bitcoin protocol. And it's actually going to be the companies that are built on top of Nostr where the value is generated. So once again, we're back to a more traditional investment lens where it's like, okay, there's a team of people with a management team, with a business plan, with a set of customers. They have equity in their business that they may or may not choose to sell. And if you buy equity in breakout businesses, then happy days. So that's what this is again here. So, you know, another couple of good points, right, is that Nostr means that there's all this activity on the Nostr protocol every single day. And how you filter that Nostr activity is up to you. So you can look at the long reads, you can look at short reads, you can look at just photographs, you can just videos. It's up to you. So what you do here is you're not having to bootstrap a social network from scratch. You have a social protocol layer to just build on top of. So there's not the classic chicken and egg problem. Like any social network business that came up, it's like, okay, well, have you got any users? No. Right, well, and what's the point of building a product which doesn't have any users? And it's that classic idea of a network effect, right? Whereas one phone is useless, two phones is better. But the way that it exponentially increases value for the network, the more phones you add. And that's an incredible, incredible thing to witness. So basically, the users are already there on Nostr. You just got to go and build for them. And that's why this is very, very like what Twitter was like back in the day, like 20 years ago when it was first founded. It was almost like a protocol layer that people were able to build apps on top of. That's kind of what Nostr is, and I reckon that's one of the reasons that Jack Dorsey is so bullish on it. In summary, the unique value proposition is that there's a series of technologies that haven't been able to be blended together before that can be leveraged, and they can be used to build products for people in a very specific niche that hasn't been tried before, which I think is very interesting. So number five, so who are the competitors and how is the company positioned? A couple of sub-points to that is like, you know, is it heavily dominated by a specific player? How do you defend your position? And have the founders done their homework? First and foremost, this is where Alex's story is important. He spent 5 years living in four different continents, and he's felt the problem. It's that classic position. It's like someone has a problem, and they realize lots of other people have the problem. Oh, if I create a solution for this, maybe this is a business. And that's precisely what we have here. So a risk here that I just wanted to raise is just this concept, like the barrier to entry for software is falling. And that's very clear given how people are using AI to create software products. So what does that mean for this business, which is predominantly a software business? It's a risk, undoubtedly. It's like the barrier to entry of someone else creating a copycat is obvious they could. But my hunch is that competitive moats are possible via excellent user experience. And that drives brand value. So if you're able just to create a really fucking good product that people like and grow brand value with that, they just keep coming back. And a great example of this is what Jack Mallers is doing with Strike, just building a really, really good product. And he's obviously a great orator who gets out there, speaks his mind, does a great job. And people like using Strike because of Jack and because of the brand that he's built. And Satlantis could be similar. And I would encourage Alex to really think about how that might be done. So basically, have a better product. Number six, what's the business model and is it scalable? Pretty simple, right? Like, how do they make money? What are the unit economics, lifetime value of a customer, customer acquisition costs? What are the margins? And can it scale? A good way of thinking about scalability is like, I'm sitting on a stool right now. For me to create a stool and sell a stool, I have to fulfill a number of processes. But it's a physical transaction with someone somewhere. And I have to do it all over again to create a second stool. So stool manufacturing has physical barriers to scalability. One of the reasons that people have had such success investing in software businesses over the last 20 years, and I'm talking about, you know, people that were able to angel invest into Twitter, into Facebook, into Instagram. There's a story of a guy that put 100 grand into Google. I mean, it's absolutely insane, right? Software is incredibly scalable. The additional cost to fulfill the same service to a second customer is very, very close to zero. I.e., you just have someone else sign up, pay you your subscription fee, and off you go. Now, as an early stage equity deal, I'm actually not too fussed about the answers to this question. And the reason is, I believe very strongly in find a good founder or identify a good founder, make sure that that market size is really, really strong, and then basically make a bet and get the fuck out of the way. Because they understand more than anyone else that they have to get these right. So if their customer acquisition cost is too high, very, very difficult to make a good business. If the lifetime value of the customer is too low, very, very difficult to make a good business. I.e., how do they reduce the cost to attract new customers, and how do they fulfill those contracts as with higher margin as possible? And those are like classic entrepreneurial problems that, given enough time, space, and capital, they'll figure it out because it's in their interest to do so. Now, a couple of other points I made about this was like, you know, I said, I'll speculate that the team can figure out a sustainable business plan. In an environment in which I can zap micropayments of Bitcoin, you can make seamless payments between B2B and B2C. So perhaps you can take a cut on those transactions that you facilitate. I really like the idea of paid memberships. Like, I'd prefer to pay if I can. And that means you're not being the product. You're not being used as a data farm. And it's a nice flip on the status quo. And paid memberships is in the investor brief, right? That's part of it. There's also an advertising section as well. I think it's fair to say that with a software business concept like this, getting well-financed and getting lots of user adoption early doors, user traction, so people who are using it, is actually far more important than profitability at this stage. So I'm not really looking for that. Like in the first couple of years of existence for Setlantis, like how well have they gone out there and promoted the business? How many users have they actually had attract to the platform? How many of those users have kept coming back? How long do they spend using the product? What kind of feedback have they got from those users? That's far more important. It's like basically they're at the crease, to use a cricket analogy, they're at the crease, they're batting, they're not out. Great. Let's see how long we can keep them there for. Another point is I thought through this recent experience where we are booking some travel, and we're actually doing it through a travel agent for the first time that my wife found. And they take a management fee up front, which is a minimal amount, but they get paid on the back end for all the stuff that we book through them. So any flights, any hotels, any transfers. And why couldn't Setlantis do the same thing? Like if they're facilitating travel and facilitating experiences, the businesses that provide the infrastructure to actually fulfill those things would pay to attract business. So I think that would definitely make sense. Now, number seven, what stage is the product at and how much traction is there? So, you know, in Canggu recently, I was reading some of Alex's Substacks where he's detailing the progress of the product, and I downloaded Test Flight on iOS and I had to play around. I thought, oh my God, in goes your Nosta details, up come all of your followers and your banner and stuff that's all there. Immediately, it's like, oh my God, there's just another client, but this one's focused on travel. Oh my gosh. And then the real light bulb moment for me is like, so hang on. So you don't have to flick between Google Maps and your social media provider any longer. I.e., this, it will just do it all. You're like, oh my God, this is cool. And so I tested it out. I see that there was already activity of people listing local businesses. And it was a first iteration. So I didn't love it. But the question is it going to be valuable? And I think it was clearly yes. There's some traction. There's an MVP out there. And I'm quite happy with all of that in terms of this question. It's not a problem for me to see a product that can be improved. What's a problem is when there's no interest in it. and there's clearly interest in it. So for that, it's like, cool, okay, this makes sense. Number eight, how will the capital be used and what are the next milestones? If you were to invest into an early stage business, what are they going to do with your money? And it's reasonable to ask, you know, are you going to go and buy US treasuries with it? Well, that is a terrible idea. Are you going to invest in building your team out? And have you got some really exciting new employees that you've got lined up that weren't able to join yet because you didn't have the funds? Great. That kind of stuff I want to hear about. And it's then a case of what's the next major, major milestone? Well, Alex mentioned on the podcast, he's looking at a Series A next year in terms of the next finance raise, and that this is actually a friends and family round. And you're like, okay, really interesting. They want to bring their close friends and family along on the ride with them. They're backing themselves in that sense. They want you to bet on their success. And also early users, like, why not give people that are already feeling this pain point some of the upside too? Like, buy some shares in the company. Why not back it like that? One thing I really cannot overemphasize is the caliber of the existing co-investors. So this is probably as important as the market size, in that, you know, when a business pivots, its market changes slightly. So you can't say outright, oh, this is a great market from the start, because if the business moves direction, then the market slightly changes. But what I do know is when Ross Stevens is involved, the founder of Stoneridge, Alan Farrington from Axiom, his funds put some money in, and then the Bitcoin Opportunity Fund with James Lavish and Mark and Larry and Brad Mills, I'm yet to have a conversation with, but a pretty prolific early stage angel investor in the Bitcoin space. These are some of the very best names in my mind that tick a very important box for any startup business, which is, can they attract the smart money? Because it's not just about getting money through the front door. It's about getting expertise and it's about getting networks. So between Stoneridge, Axiom, and the Bitcoin Opportunity Fund, you've got address books into like some of the most important places you can guess or you can imagine. And so if I was to put money into this business, in some ways, I'm investing alongside them and my capital's getting access to their address book as well, which is absolutely brilliant. Not to mention, you know, their considerable amounts of expertise over and above what I've been through in my life. So this is absolutely massive for me. It's like, okay, cool company, good problem, like the founder. Ooh, okay, look who's put money in it already. And so I'm very confident that this business will be able to attract future funding. And that gives me great great peace of mind, in a sense, and is a way of de-risking what is a risky, risky bet. One thing to mention as well in terms of how the capital will be used, like Alex has already put some money into a Bitcoin treasury from the previous funding round, and they will do so again, I believe. This strategy is still very, very nascent. Startup businesses couldn't put money into Bitcoin before. Like the idea they can own sound money themselves is, you know, it's a whole new ballgame. But what it basically does is it gives the business a longer time frame in which it has to become successful. Number nine, what is the current valuation and does it make sense? Is it reasonable? Is it too high? Is it too low? What's the risk at this value? Is there enough traction so far? What's the roof? So like, can you reasonably think, yeah, this business could be 10 times more valuable? And the point there is that that's the lens that you need to have when you're putting money into an early stage business. Because really, you're probably better off making 10 bets on 10 companies, of which 9 of them will fail and 1 of them hits a home run. And they need to be able to 10x in order to pay back all the other capital that you lost. It's a very, very standard kind of venture style investing lens. And so for me, when I see the valuation that they've put on the business around 17 million, it's totally reasonable and I'm comfortable with it. And I saw the valuation that they had on the previous round. So they've upticked from the previous round, but they've made progress over the last year. So that's fair enough. And the valuation that they'll try and hit in 2026 for a Series A will be something in the 20s. So there should be, you know, give or take a 50% or 100% uptick on your money in the next 12 months. But keep in mind, this is highly illiquid, very long-term investing. So it's just as much an art as it is a science when it comes to valuing startup businesses. It's a private equity deal. So it's really only as valuable as someone is willing to pay for that equity. So it's often you're sitting on a lot of paper gains. It's not until the company actually exits that you get that money out. But I've seen VC pitch decks where they're talking about companies that they've got in their fund, and they'll talk about the valuations of those business. And Series A, like, it's not crazy to be sitting at $25, $30 million. It depends, obviously, on the company itself and the product and the progress they've made. For me, just off the top of my head, seeing this company valued at $250 million is not crazy in 5 years from now. So easily a 10x is possible. That's because of this convergence of technologies that haven't been seen before. It's like, why wouldn't someone want to have a Google Maps combined with Instagram, combined with TripAdvisor, that gives them better recommendations than they've ever seen before that can't be taken away from them? Like, obviously, people are going to go for it, right? A good point here I just forgot or I almost went past is that it's cool that this is a global market. So one of the things that I touched on before that's frustrating about Bitcoin exchange, for example, it's very geographically based. So it's really hard to see how that might scale because they've got local financial regulations. Whereas this is a frequent traveler. They could be anywhere in the world and they'd find this software product useful. So that to me is really helpful in terms of scaling. And a good thing to think through is like, is this a 10x technology play? Yes or no? So does it make something 10x faster? Does it make it 10x stronger, 10x cheaper? And if it can, then it has the ability to hugely increase in value. And when you combine AI, Bitcoin, and Nostr, I think, yes, like absolutely, that's what's going on here. Okay, so number 10, finally. So what is your personal risk tolerance and exit horizon? Can you lose this money? Are you prepared for an illiquid investment for 7 to 10 years? Are you happy with the risk reward? Ultimately, this all comes down to your own preference. And for me, it's like, think about it as an allocation, essentially. So total up your net assets. What's 0.5% of that? Well, if you lost 0.5% of your net wealth, is it the end of the world? No. Therefore, that might be a suitable way to think about how much money to invest in a company like this. Now, keep in mind that it's early stage and they're likely to invest. They're likely to take on more funding, so you will get diluted. Often, you'll see in the small print, you'll get pro rata rights as an existing shareholder, so you'll get to buy more shares when they're you get to buy more shares when they are created at whatever the price might be at that stage. The downside is quite simple, like all your money's gone. But the upside is, I've written here, the next Instagram with maps built in that can't be taken from you. Well, yes, please. Like, how cool does that sound? In terms of an exit, I'm not that phased at this stage. Like, it's just something so far away. I'd much prefer the money that I put into a business be used to focus on the traction. Like, traction, 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 traction. Where are the users? What's their problem? How do you solve them? How do you get paid? And if you can figure that out, then before you know it, you'll be getting inquiries from the, you know, more than like I'd say that the social media giants waking up to the opportunity. A couple other points is like a sats flow business is very powerful. This is something I've been studying. If you're getting paid in Bitcoin, that's also accumulating purchasing power over time, it completely changes the dynamics of a startup business. So if you can get paid by your customers and then keep that month to month to month, and your balance sheet's growing month to month to month, that makes you a very, very interesting company to own equity in. And maybe you don't even need to exit. Maybe you can just do dividends. I don't know. And I'd be open to whatever the founder feels is the right thing at the time. Point here is you're backing them and you will profit in the upside as well as taking the risk with them. Now, before I wrap this up, there's some kind of bonus points here I wanted to share. If this founder fails, would you bet on them again? So it's like Alex is going to have a good crack at this for sure. He's got money in the bank. He's got a team together. He's got some early traction and it's going to be, you know, a really good go. But it might fail. And if it does fail, all the shit they've learned, well, would you bet on them again? And I think it's quite simple for me, yes. What's the pedigree of the co-investors? Touched on this before, but like off the charts. Those are some of the best people that I would want to be on a cap table with. And like how cool that you get to be part of an early stage company that they've already put money into and more than likely would come charging in for the Series A in a year or so's time. The golf buggy test, you may have heard me talk about this before, but it's something I learned in the past that I really like. So you go to the golf club with your buddies and you roll up onto the first tee, and the topic of conversation is someone, you know, dropping bombs on how they just invest in this really cool startup. And, you know, aside being Bitcoin passes the golf buggy test better than anything else I've ever heard of ever before. But if a company isn't kind of sexy enough or cool enough or trendy enough, then someone's not going to kind of brag about it in the golf club. And the test is a kind of amusing one in a sense, but basically it's, is this going to be a business that is easy for them to attract more funding? Yes or no? And if it's a yes, then it makes it easier to bet on that business. And for me, Stellantis passes the golf buggy test. Like, how could you not talk about an Instagram, Google Maps combination that can't be taken from you? Like, it's huge. Are you investing in lines or dots? This is another trick that I picked up in the past, where if you think about what you're doing right now, so anyone that's listened to this end of the podcast, I hope you've enjoyed this analysis so far and found it useful, and you can reapply it in your own way to think about whether or not you might invest in Stellantis. But for all of us, this is the first time that we've seen Stellantis as a pitch deck. So we can see the founding team, we can see the traction so far, we can see the product so far. It's a data point. Now, in 12 months' time, or whatever it is, 18 months' time, when they do a Series A, the pitch deck will be different. And they'll have more traction data, and they'll have more product data, and they'll have more of a product to go and play around with, and they'll have a bigger team. The question it becomes is, when you join those two dots together, how rapid a vertical line is that? Is it just flat, i.e. there's not been much progress made, or is there very clearly like big progress being made by the business? And if there's big progress being made, then basically investing again is a great idea. Now, for this particular lens, as I said before, this is the first time I've looked at the Stellantis pitch deck and the first time I've had an opportunity to invest in the company. So from a traditional sense of using this test, it's a dot. So I'm not investing in a line. I don't have a second data point, and therefore I can't figure out progress. But what I can say is, I've watched this founder over the last 3 years, and for me, there's very, very clear progress. So I'm willing to bet on him based on this particular business use case. Finally, do you have access to follow-on capital? And, you know, think about it today. Okay, so were you to put 0.5% of your net wealth into this company, if they raise funds in a year's time and you want to keep your percentage of the business in terms of net equity, then you'll need to get another 0.5% of your net wealth, whatever it is at the time, to follow on with. And, or you may need more even, depending on the price of the equity that's being sold. Basically, if you make a good bet, like in any game of poker, you want to follow the winners. And that's what that's really about. So in conclusion, I've said, make the bet, Jake. So I'm going to invest in Stellantis, subject to any, like there's some more due diligence I've got to do. I'll show you that in a second. But my intention right now is, this is the first angel investment I'm going to have made in over 5 years. And it's because it's the convergence of a number of areas that I'm extremely bullish about. And because of this due diligence process I've just taken you through. It's like, make the bet, Jake. And part of this as well being, you know, as investors, I'm going to take you through timestamp in just a second, or take you to it. Next steps being, you know, check the finer details. What is in the term sheet? What's in the shareholder agreement? What traction data has been provided? What are the customer contracts? You know, actually start looking at, like, okay, how many people they signed up? And you get a bit more flavor for it. But just from a kind of mindset perspective, it's then going to be a case of sit, wait, be patient, support the business where you can, watch for weakness, watch for positive progress. And then when the next funding round comes around, you can pull the trigger. Have they made progress? Is that line that you've seen in terms of data point of progress going up rapidly? In which case, jump on in, because you might well have hit a winner. And imagine, just imagine what it would be like to own equity from an early stage business that has the kind of growth trajectory that are now in what are considered the large tech companies on publicly listed exchanges, where, you know, it's like, wow, imagine if you had equity in Instagram, like massive, or early Twitter, like massive wealth creation. And that's really what early stage equity investing is you're chasing these 5 to 10 year long, illiquid, high risk, but huge reward returns. So just a final step, this is timestamp. And it is a crowdfunding website that Alex mentioned for the first time. I'd not heard of it before, that also incorporates Bitcoin. There's more information here on the actual pitch deck and stuff of Setlantis. I encourage you to check it out. I'm going through the sign up process at the moment. And there is a due diligence process that Timestamp takes you through in order to then send funds to an escrow account. And they will then try and, it says that the target raise of 100K and the cap is 800K. So they'll basically pool together all the different equity crowdfund investors into an escrow account. And if they hit those targets, then they'll release those funds to the company and the investment raise will be done. As a very final point, just in case he ever listens to this, the founder of Timestamp, I believe, is called Armin, and he was on email to me a couple of days ago, who is an example of someone I'd love to get onto the podcast and learn, like, why are you building Timestamp and how did it come about? I only heard of it very recently because of the Setlantis process, and I'd love to learn some more. So with that, I'm going to stop sharing my screen, and I hope you found that valuable. It's certainly been a useful process for me to go through and figure out, is this a good bet or is it not? At the end of the day, it's your money. Do what you want with it. Do your own research. And just, I think it's so important for us to take risk, especially in this instance. You know, it's a company that's clearly very interesting, but also from your perspective, like, if it's money that no one should just throw money away. But if you're clever about how you size the position, then in theory, it's okay if you don't get it back. But if we don't invest in early stage innovation, if we don't make bets on top entrepreneurs, if we don't make any kind of effort to actually build things, nothing will happen. So we've got to go out there and make it. And I just want to finish with one cool concept, which I heard on a clip recently, a BTC Sessions clip. And it was a discussion around the joint stock contract. And if you take yourself back 500 years before the US was ever discovered by Europeans, and there was essentially a form of doing business in which a trader, adventurer, pioneer, whatever you might call them, would say, okay, I'm going to go on a trip to India or South Africa or wherever it might be. I'm going to build a ship. I'm going to take a crew. I'm going to go and discover some stuff. And I'm going to bring back scarce raw materials that the European markets are desperately in need of and will create huge returns. The risk, storm, being eaten by cannibals, being killed by pirates, who knows, extraordinary risks. But the point was, is you give me the money, I'll do the thing. We together sign a joint stock contract. And it was that innovation that unlocked capital for the discovery of the United States of America. And discovery, I mean, from a European perspective. But what I think is going on now is the early phase of the digital renaissance. So instead of creating a ship and sailing physically across oceans and bringing back physical raw materials, we're funding entrepreneurs that are setting sail in cyberspace. And they're figuring out the best way of doing that. And they're pooling together different technologies in order to survive. So Bitcoin is just one part of that. Nostr is another part of that. AI is another part of that. And the risk reward is similar, right? The risk is all the capital's gone. The loss of life is not as high, of course. Like, people probably never return home from those trips. But it's similar, right? I hope you get a flavor for that, because I really love trying to pull into context from a historical perspective, how important some of this stuff is. And what we might look back in the past is like, oh my God, that was actually much more of a big deal than we realized. But if there wasn't someone out there that was willing to bet on people circumnavigating the globe in search of resources, then we wouldn't have seen the history of the last 500 years. So I'll leave you with that. Good luck figuring out whether or not you want to invest in Setlantis. It's something that I am very bullish on, and I will be jumping through the due diligence process this week with Timestamp and getting my money in there. So if you have any questions at all, do let me know. Thank you.